There's a new frontier for political persecution in the West, the weaponization of financial tools against political enemies. We're hearing a growing number of stories involving groups and individuals that have been finding themselves cut off from financial services or bank accounts, just like what happened to the truckers in Canada. Governments are increasingly able to punish people for doing things they don't like by pushing corporations to do their bidding. Question is, where is all this headed? What's behind the push for central bank digital currencies? Are we seeing growing signs of China's social credit system being deployed in the West? Today on Fallout, we're discussing some alarming trends, but I do want to share a personal story also that could be useful in strategizing how to fight back against all of this. Hello, everyone, and welcome to Fallout.
So, Robert, I recently had Eddie Cornell, one of the people that was debanked during the, let's call it the truckers crisis in Canada. I want to quickly roll a clip of him, something he was saying, right? But basically, so he's saying, I felt betrayed. I've never been convicted of a crime.
I wasn't charged of a crime, and yet my government found it necessary to label me and freeze everything I own. There I was, no cash, no access to my credit cards, nothing. And I had no money for gas, I had no money for lodging, nothing for food.
So this is a phenomenon that's actually, you know, since that time, that's almost become something that's common that we keep hearing about. It struck me something that Bobby Kennedy talked about very recently. He coined this, either coined it or developed a term someone else had come up with, transactional freedom. And he equated it with something very similar to a level of importance to freedom of speech. And that really kind of captured my imagination as we see this massive push towards the central bank digital currency adoption. And recently, we're seeing that SWIFT is trying to come up with a system to kind of bring all these things together.
SWIFT is the really main universal banking system of the West right now. And to some extent, it's also integrated into communist China, into the CCP system. With this latest Reuters article, there's clear documentation of at least two major banks in China being involved in this new SWIFT push to implement central bank digital currency on a global scale. And all of the things that that implies, which leads into the Chinese system that the West seems to be enamored of right now, which is the use of weaponized banking as part of a social credit system to control behavior at the level of individuals.
It's not even a kind of weaponization of the system. It is the system. Right? It's the idea of basically using your funds, your finances as a tool of social control. Here's the thing you can spend on. If you spend on certain things, that will actually raise your social credit score and give you kind of unlimited access to buying whatever you like. However, if you spend on other things or do other things that are recorded, that actually may lessen your ability and does lessen your ability to do certain things, including, for example, green pass to travel and to even take the train. If you had the wrong color on your COVID status on your phone, you just couldn't take the train at all. Like that level of micro control of behavior using your finances as a tool to get you to behave correctly.
So the green passport isn't just something that was deployed in communist China, but it was deployed all across Europe. Mm-hmm. And as you point out, it was really first deployed in a widespread fashion in response to the promoted fear of COVID. And all of this is really part of this great reset agenda, quote unquote, that originally we were told was a conspiracy theory until it was published as a book from the World Economic Forum leader Klaus Schwab. The idea that populations can be controlled, beginning with, on a macro level, weaponization of finance against nation states, and all for the right reasons, as is often the case with this kind of incrementalism. We started off with, for instance, the example of the Iranian Republic and the need to somehow have a mechanism for imposing diplomatic sanctions against the Iranian Republic and the Ayatollahs in a time when they were almost impervious to any diplomatic efforts And so there
financial
was,
sanctions.
This
means,
was,
yeah,
this
yeah,
was
right.
the use of financial sanctions mm-hmm. and blocking their access to funds that they had been depositing in Western banks, particularly in New York banks. There was widespread consensus that this was appropriate. There was a need to control and influence the Ayatollah's behavior.
In one case, you have a murderous dictatorship that seeks an end to America, a really bad actor. And of course, this has been applied in multiple cases. It's an approach that makes a ton of sense.
In the absence of any other options, you're left with finance as one of your
your other options
tools.
Are military, which
yeah.
that and that
kinetic
that, warfare. And that hasn't gone well.
Yeah.
So you think to yourself, well, maybe I'll use this to prevent this bad actor from doing horrible things.
Right.
And the problem is when you start thinking to yourself, well, I have these instruments now, these tools, and I can use them. Why don't I use them more broadly? Maybe that's appropriate.
And yeah. so we went ahead and deployed them against Russia in response to its aggression in Ukraine. And by the way, a lot of that was done through the SWIFT system of isolating
Correct.
Russia. So Russia took the position, Putin took the position, well, if you're going to do that, then I'm just going to set up my own banking system. And that has given rise to this BRICS currency consortium that is now a major threat to the dollar globally and the petrodollar. So another example of unintended consequences of fallout. But that now has been extended down to the level of the individual. And as you point out, the first real wake-up call for the world was when Justin Trudeau and Chrystia Freeland deployed this same strategy that we had all agreed was appropriate in the case of these bad actors on the international stage and brought it down to the level of truckers in Canada exercising constitutionally allowed free speech within Canada in protest to the policies which would require them to be vaccinated if they were to continue to do their work.
The attempt, of course, by the powers that be was to portray this as an insurrection. The truckers are coming to take over Parliament Hill. When a law was passed saying you can't honk, they stopped honking. That was the level of compliance to the law.
Completely peaceful, completely compliant, and yet the government pulled the usual tricks of trying to label them as far-right neo-Nazis and apparently also included planting disruption or chaos agents within the trucker movement to act as if they were neo-Nazis. So this is the kind of notorious strategy of false flag actions to delegitimize a movement.
The bottom line was they decided to debank them in a myriad of ways, right?
Yep.
So this is, you know, Bobby Kennedy in this article, this trucker tells Kennedy that he's going to jail for being unable to pay his alimony because he's been debanked.
Right.
He's like, right? It occurred to me that transactional freedom is as important as freedom of the press. If you have freedom of speech in the First Amendment, and yet when you exercise that speech, the government doesn't like it. They can starve you to death. They can throw you out of your home because you can't pay your mortgage or your rent. Then that is meaningless. Aha, uh-huh, interesting.
Yeah, that's a Kennedy quote.
Yeah.
I'm struck by the parallels between this Canadian trucker protest and the global consequences, kind of the pivot point internationally. And the solidarity movement in Poland that was also relatively spontaneous and caused a major shift. And a case can be made really is what triggered the fall of the Soviet Union because it delegitimized that structure. And likewise, in this case, we've had the truckers and this debanking effort trigger a cascade in Canada that resulted in an amazing set of actions by the government in which they confronted the risk that they had triggered the potential collapse of the entire Canadian banking system.
Yeah, there was like, let's call it this rapid backpedaling, right?
Yeah. That would be the most generous way to put it,
right.
Where suddenly Freeland and Trudeau were faced with the consequences of their action and the realization by the rest of the world that Canadian banking was no longer a safe haven for the very wealthy, particularly Asian money that had often sought refuge in the Canadian banking system, particularly Chinese money from Chinese oligarchs and the families that held that. And so suddenly there was a threat that they were going to pull their funds out of the Canadian banking system and collapse its liquidity. And this required a sudden action, a prompt action by Krista Friedland, the director or minister of finance for the Canadian government, to reverse that. And then, of course, fast forward to the present, we have the Supreme Court in Canada deciding that this evocation of the Emergencies Act was unlawful and unconstitutional. I find it fascinating still that both Krista Friedland and Justin Trudeau and infamously Klaus Schwab bragged that most of Canadian leadership has been trained and placed into those positions by the World Economic Forum. So Krista Friedland and Justin Trudeau are both World Economic Forum trained young leaders, which is a multi-year training program, essentially an indoctrination program. So they're acting in alignment with the policies that have been discussed at length within the World Economic Forum as a way to foster this major change in global finance and political organization called the Great Reset.
Let me jump back here to this. So in this piece that we have, you know, about, you know, Bobby Kennedy's comments on this transactional issue of transactional freedom, he basically comes out very strongly against CBDCs. Similarly, the leading Republican candidate, former President Trump, has said no CBDCs. That's kind of my summary of the version. Now, why is that? Well, today we had this very interesting piece that we both read this morning. The headline is Swift Planning Launch of a New Central Bank Digital Currency Platform in 12 to 24 months. Now, what is this platform? The platform is a way for different central bank digital currencies to seamlessly communicate with each other. It's actually astonishing. So the way this article is written in a way that's almost, it's bizarre. It takes as a foregone conclusion that CBDC adoption will be universal. Of course, this is the right way. Of course, this is how it will be. And of course, it makes perfect sense to make things, you know, incredibly efficient. We know exactly how CBDCs work, looking at the China model. Chinese Communist Party has shown us the purpose, the utilization, the approach. You know, essentially, as we discussed earlier, control of every aspect of your life using your access to finance, to your finance, including behavioral modification ahead of time, where right. You kind of incentivize people to for certain types of behaviors and disincentivize them for others. I mean, this is an astonishing level of control. But here, if I'm to believe Reuters, this is just how it's going to be.
Well, remember, right? Reuters is closely tied to the World Economic Forum. Mm-hmm. So you can think of Reuters as almost an official voice of this globalist movement for one world government and centralized control based around the logic of the dominance of public-private partnerships, economic and business partnerships in particular, which I argue meets Mussolini's definition of fascism.
The thing is, this isn't an opinion piece, right? You know, but with Reuters, I mean, we use Reuters to help, you know, sort of buffer some of our reporting. You know, when we get some good factual information that they pull from different parts of the world, we have to do a little bit of verification, but it's helpful, mm-hmm. right? But it's just a way of thinking.
Just like human-caused climate change is a baseline assumption. One of the core baseline assumptions now that have been normalized is necessary to implement, as this Reuters article calls it, a token for international and national and regional exchange in lieu of issued currency or precious metals for that matter, that would be this alternative, really an alternative to Bitcoin, an alternative to these decentralized digital currencies. And the difference is that with the CBDC, what we have is a centralized digital currency that's controlled by the various federal or national banks. That control flows up to the Bank of International Settlements, and then the SWIFT system basically becomes the transmission to allow the interconnectivity, just like SWIFT is right now with standard currencies. And the goal, as laid out by SWIFT and many of these others that are involved in this push towards this centralized digital token that would be controllable, is the reduction of friction, the elimination of the transactional costs. So this is economics. The elimination or reduction in the transactional costs associated with a decentralized world. Big business and big finance don't like that. It costs time and it costs extra money because they have to be compliant with the requirements for each independent nation state. And in a globalized, harmonized, central command economy structure, which is what's being promoted. They wish to have a transaction system where there are no differences. So they don't have to have multiple regulatory capabilities and compliance capabilities. They can just interact seamlessly across the entire world.
I think they say it replicates 1,000 different relationships, which would have to be negotiated for this to work in the first place. It makes me actually think of the U.S. system. I've come to really admire the genius of the system, right? Because the assumption was, of course, that people would want power, would seek power, and would seek to accumulate it quickly if possible. So let's set up a system, while still functional, that actually prevents that from happening too quickly, like in one administration or, you know, in one set sitting of Congress or something like that, or maybe even a few.
What you're referring to is the representational republic, mm-hmm. which was set up in the Constitution as opposed to a democracy. Often that term democracy has been weaponized and is used as a euphemism for American Western political structure. But in fact, we don't live in a democracy. We live in a republic in which there are, as you point out, as these checks and balances, in theory, decentralized control of all aspects of political life that aren't specifically vested with the federal government, and that vests to the states. So we truly, in terms of the Constitution, have a system in which there's been an intention to push the authority for decisions and political management down to the lowest possible level. I think there's a term for that.
Yeah, the principle of subsidiarity. That's the idea. I'm not sure we apply that very well these days. That whatever activities can be done by a political unit, like a unit of government, it should be done at the smallest scale level possible to achieve that outcome. The higher you go in the structure.
So the principle of subsidiarity is really kind of fancy academic intellectual talk for decentralization,
yeah.
Decentralization of power. Yeah. One of the things that triggered the fall of the Austro-Hungarian Empire was a migration from the principle of subsidiarity or decentralization of political control towards a more totalitarian autocracy, which is absolutely what happened. And then that central leader got toppled as a consequence of the cascade of events that started with the assassination of Archbishop Duke Ferdinand prior to World War I. And we're in another cycle in which there's this push to control, to move towards one world government, to move towards an integration of very large commercial interests and very large governmental interests. This move we call globalism and has various structures that have been set up to promote it, in part by our intelligence community, notoriously with a very strong involvement of Henry Kissinger, and all built around the thesis that the real world is described by real politic, this idea that there really are no core moral principles, that anything goes in the transactions between political forces and nation states. Mm-hmm. And we need to acknowledge that and live in this real world where anything is acceptable and all that matters is pure power and interests of those power blocks behind it.
There's multiple examples in here. Bank of America debanking Indigenous Advanced Ministries. We have JP Morgan Chase debanking the National Committee for Religious Freedom, actually led by former Senator and U.S. Ambassador Sam Brownback, a great respect work around religious freedom. Basically, people being debanked for holding the wrong religious or political opinions, right? That's kind of where this incrementalism, as you described it, has led.
And they're doing it through a bunch of nefarious strategies, such as data mining your purchases of books, for instance, or showing in your bank account transactions keywords such as Donald Trump. That's being data mined by gaining access to their bank account records directly or surreptitiously, and then data mining those for these keywords, and then acting in this arbitrary and capricious way to deplatform them from financial transactions. And for instance, in the case of the truckers, and there's been other examples of that, I've experienced one myself, mm-hmm. they'll hold your funds. So you can have a substantial amount of money in your bank account or in a donor account or whatever the vehicle is, and they'll just arbitrarily close your access to that. And when confronted, often they come up with all kinds of excuses, nothing direct. And that's really documented in this essay that you're talking about titled Debanking, Cancel Culture's Newest Threat. And what it documents is repeated examples of these banks like Chase or Bank of America acting in this way and then being confronted and giving a variety of excuses for their actions rather than being transparent about why they've actually done it. And why do they do that? Because they know it's wrong. Mm-hmm. That's the fundamental thing here, mm-hmm. is there's a recognition that this is bad behavior, mm-hmm. that this is not acceptable, and yet they still feel that it is appropriate to do it because it's justified by a greater cause, which is the ostensible threat of political dissidents. They are seemingly debanking people because they aren't endorsing the approved narrative scaffold that defines what is the range of acceptable discourse. In a sense, what they're doing is they are applying the Overton window. And for those that are outside of the range of acceptable discourse, mm-hmm. on any given topic, gun mm-hmm. control, the approved discourse, mm-hmm. not the legal discourse, mm-hmm. the approved narrative or the narrative scaffold, if you're outside of that, if you're mm-hmm. outside of that Overton window, mm-hmm. then you're at risk for potentially being debanked. Now, think about what we just said and covered. What we're really saying is we're already facing an incremental deployment of the social credit system. But most people have no idea, unless they get caught like the truckers did in an abrupt event where it's deployed against them, they're unaware that they are being boiled, using the metaphor of the frog.
Well, you know, I want to jump in on something that happened to you recently. You know, Stripe, which is the payment, the company for Substack that runs their transactions, you basically got a letter that they wanted to have kind of a full view of your your banking situation, that they just needed you to kind of click a button and help facilitate that.
Stripe is so much more than the credit card transaction processor. That's their business model. They're relatively new. They're largely backed by an investment fund that is set up by Jared Kushner's brother. Stripe, as of last year, passed $1 trillion in U.S. financial transactions. They have rapidly become the go-to internet credit card processing and transaction company. They don't just control all credit card processing having to do with subscriptions, paid subscriptions on Substack. They also control all transactions, financial transactions having to do with Twitter and most of the other platforms, Squarespace, almost anything that you touch on the internet right now. If you're doing a financial transaction involving your credit card or debit card, Stripe is managing that. If you try to contact Stripe and say, what have you done here? What you just get is a runaround. Basically, you get another version of you violated community standards, without defining what it is that your transgression is. So Libs of TikTok got financially deplatformed from the obligatory credit card processing transaction manager for X, which is Stripe. And that the person behind Libs of TikTok complained directly to Elon Musk, who follows that account. And somehow magically, within a short period of time, Stripe said that, well, this was a misunderstanding, functionally, and they would restore the account. Elon or one of his agents, one of his lieutenants, interacted directly with Stripe to say, cut it out. And so then Stripe turned on, just as they were able to turn off with a throw of a digital switch, Libs of TikTok's account. And they came up with an explanation, which was that, oh, it was all a misunderstanding because it was listed technically in the wording for that account as TikTok, instead of Libs of TikTok.
Sure.
And so that was their justification. I'm not aware of Stripe turning off all transactions having to do with TikTok, but that was their justification for what they did, is there was ambiguity. We received a notice about 3 weeks ago in which we were told by both Substack and by Stripe, they didn't initially demand, they requested that we provide full access to integration of our professional bank account, RW Malone MD LLC, this bank account that we've had with Wells Fargo for years and years and years, in which Stripe is now over 2 years of financial transactions with. We were requested to allow Stripe full access to all of the transaction records from my professional account, which means they would have access to all of my travel history, my future travel plans, any funds or name of individuals that had made donations, any of my clients in the past, any medical customers that I've provided advice to. Because I've run a consultancy business for various biotech companies, all records having to do with those transactions, etc. So they would have, and not to mention all the records of our transactions having to do with our horse business and our farm business, they would have everything historically that we've ever done using that Wells Fargo account. All because of what? Well, they claim that this was due to a federal request, but they won't disclose what that request was. And they have spoken about it as necessary under federal rules having to do with knowing your customer. And so when we got this request, and by the way, we were given about a week or 9 days to comply, because this request was then followed by a demand. Mm-hmm. You must do this. Mm-hmm. Otherwise, we will turn off access to all revenue coming from your subscribers to your Substack account, which is to say we would be completely cut off of our revenue because we rely on Substack now to make our living. And we built up that Substack business over pushing 3 years now of daily diligent work to support our customers, our subscribers, our paid subscribers. So Substack would suddenly cut off all funds if we didn't concede to their demand to full access to all our bank account records. And faced with this, I was upset, Jill was upset. And so what we did, which is, I guess, different from many people who just post something on Twitter or complain about it and then end up complying because they think they have no other choice, we went to a law firm. Now, unfortunately, this is something that most people can't do. We had enough cash in the bank that we were able to drop a substantial amount of money to set up a retainer for a major First Amendment law firm, Dillon Law Group, in order to challenge this demand from Stripe. There was a long time lag between mm-hmm. the law firm almost immediately submitting a demand letter with various criteria having to do with what Stripe needed to do to stop this behavior and activity, or else there would be certain legal consequences. Stripe and Substack basically ignored that. And Substack wrote to me imploring that I speak personally with a representative of Stripe. My response was, no, I'm sorry, we have now had to retain a lawyer and you can have all your discussions with the attorney, which apparently triggered internal dialogue within Stripe to engage between their legal department and the people that had set up the policy. The appearance is that this was arbitrary and capricious action on the part of some Stripe administrators. Mm. And they hadn't really vetted this with Stripe Legal, mm-hmm. which we knew from the due diligence of the Dillon Law Group, what they were doing was not legal because they were stopping arbitrarily the revenue coming from our business, our subscribers, for no apparent reason other than vague citation of something that the federal government had asked them to do, which, by the way, they will still not disclose to us. Mm-hmm. What was this inciting event, mm-hmm. this trigger, mm-hmm. which led us to talking about and speculating about this Jim Jordan reveal that came from the Judicial Subcommittee
on
Weaponization of Government, yeah. that documented that there have been hundreds and hundreds of people swept up in kind of a dragnet by Department of Justice that have used exactly this strategy of getting access to people's bank records and then data mining that
and
for
and then finding the reason to target them
yeah.
after the fact.
So yeah. the good news is that by acting promptly at our own expense, we were able to get Stripe to rapidly back down without any explanation. Mm-hmm. They sent us a letter basically acknowledging that to our attorney this time, finally communicating directly with our attorney, the attorney's client, Robert Malone, objected to this policy and that they had found a way to accommodate this. And we received this amazing form in which there was a series of questions that seemed to be basically focused on whether or not we would be creditworthy and would seek to obtain a loan from Stripe. It's absolutely bizarre that we went from, you must provide us all access to your historic financial records in order for us to comply with the Know Your Customer requirements and mm-hmm. some other communication that's coming from the federal government mm-hmm. to, oh no, you just have to fill out this form that's basically an initial due diligence on whether or not you would be creditworthy for us to give you a loan. And they've been trying to solicit us to obtain a $100,000 plus loan from them, basically weekly for 2 years. So I think part of what's going on here may be that Stripe is trying to transition from its current business plan of just credit card processing to basically becoming a major financial institution mm-hmm. and engaging in lending. And it's seeking intelligence about potential customers. Mm-hmm. But my concern is they want to data mine our bank account records with AI or whatever other tools, probably as part of a larger effort. Mm-hmm. But what's odd is that some others have received this type of communication. And although Stripe denies that there's any political aspect to this initiative that they've launched in a very selective way, apparently Alex Berenson also has received this type of communication. And in particular, Emerald Robinson, who broadcasts for the Lindell Broadcasting Network, also received exactly this type of communication at almost precisely the same time. Mm-hmm. Now, what's also fascinating is I got a call the other day from Naomi Wolf. She has received communication also from Stripe. This is very recently, so after we made all our objections. But all they're asking from her is her Social Security number, which is absolutely allowable by the federal government if the credit card processing agency is processing transactions for you. Mm-hmm. They have the federal right to ask for your Social Security number. But we're now in an environment in which the federal government, as Jim Jordan and his committee has identified, is weaponizing and integrating activities within one branch of the federal government to support other branches and the initiatives and interests of other branches. So the concern we have is that they were trying to get access to all of our bank account records through potentially justice, if it's this Jim Jordan mechanism, which then can be passed off to, say, Treasury and the IRS, because the IRS doesn't have the right to get full access to your bank account unless you're committed to some fraudulent activity or such. Furthermore, Stripe could choose to selectively reveal information about our financial records to hostile agents, whether it's the government or it's corporate media, and use that as part of a smear campaign, this wrap-up smear idea that I've been subjected to, as has Epoch Times and so many others. Mm-hmm. What are the boundaries on our right to financial privacy? It's not just this issue of transactional freedom, but it is also a privacy right.
There's innumerable, I think, examples and numerous ones that I'm aware of, you know, terrorist plots being foiled by following the money, so to speak.
Right.
Right. And that there's value to
and,
that.
And RICO actions.
Right.
Racketeering and corrupt action statutes 100%. Specifically allow this type of data searching.
These types of instruments, they make sense in a certain context. In another context, they make no sense. They become horrible weapons, you know, against the most decent of people.
So I think we can all agree that bona fide terrorist organizations should be blocked from raising capital. We truly want to debank bona fide terrorist organizations that are aiming to kill human beings mm-hmm. and cause economic or other disruption or deploy weapons of mass destruction. But then once you get the agreement on some of these terms, we're against terrorism. We believe that domestic terrorists and foreign terrorists should be debanked and blocked from access to capital, then it becomes an easy incremental step to just redefine what those terms mean, which is why it was so critical when the Department of Homeland Security defined mis, dis, and malinformation, basically information which is different from the narrative scaffold approved by the federal government and the World Health Organization. Yeah. So, of course, all this relates to this Supreme Court case that's currently being heard, Murthy versus Missouri, perhaps going to be the seminal First Amendment case heard certainly this term, and stems from the censorship that was performed by the federal government against people who were speaking against the narrative concerning COVID and the lockdowns originally.
And there's 20,000 pages of discovery to kind of buttress the argument that the federal government was actually coercing the social media companies to do all this extensive, both algorithmic and specific censorship.
So we should get into that in a future episode, because you've got a lot of insight having sat in on these hearings and listened directly.
I would like to talk about it, because it was kind of astonishing to see how that the oral arguments went. They didn't go the way that I was imagining they would. So a ton of fodder for future Fallout episodes. Why don't we take a break now, head out into the countryside, head out to your farm, where I've been doing a ton of learning from you and Jill.
Sounds like a plan.
Welcome to today's segment on Health and Home with the Malones. Our goal today is to not only teach Jan how to use the tractor and various farm implements, but also to show all of you that if you want to take a dive at homesteading or farmsteading, you're going to need a small tractor, but so long as you stay safe and understand how to use the implements, you can work the soil, mow, and do all the things you need for a small farm with a modest-sized tractor. In this case, it's a 55 horse. Then with Jan, what we're going to do is start with teaching him how to operate the tractor, straightforward stuff involving hitching implements onto the tractor, being careful about the power takeoff and the three-point hitch, and just seeing how the whole system works. So come on down here and let's talk a little bit about why we're doing this and about safety. So the key point with this segment is to really show our viewers that if they're interested in small farming, they can do it. But you do have to be smart. Farm equipment is really pretty dangerous. And with tractors, the one thing that you most have to be worried about and aware of is the power takeoff. And the power takeoff is basically the drive shaft that goes through to the tractor engine. It's got all kinds of torque. It's coming directly off that diesel engine with 50 horses of power. And what the accident that happens again and again with power takeoffs, including the drive shaft, which is what this is, you notice this has got a plastic protector on it,
right,
rather than an open metal drive shaft, is that people have loose clothing and they start turning the power takeoff or the drive shaft, and it catches their clothing and pulls them into the tractor, and it'll just chew your arm right off. So it's easy to be safe if you're paying attention. Anybody can do this. It's not a big, huge thing.
Mm-hmm.
So what you want to do is align those splines so that it catches properly. And there it is. Mm-hmm. It's on, it's clicked. Those little ball bearings that hold it in have fallen into place, and this collar is locked. So now we want to put the shield in place. Again, be safe. And now we have the three-point hitch connected. It's locked in place. All the pins are in. And you can go ahead and get on the tractor and start it up again.
All right. Wow. And
what this is called a bush hog. It's a big commercial mower is what it is. And it's got a huge spinning blade inside, and this will chew up branches and trees and all kinds of stuff.
All right, well, I'm ready to rock here.
Let's give it some juice. Now, remember I said that this will drop it.
Right.
But if we pull back, it's going to lift it. And let's go mow a field.
All right.
Okay?
Yeah.
So go ahead. We're going down there. Down? Yes, okay, perfect. Corn crop that we're going to plant after the soil warms up a little bit more. Can you back up just a little bit? Oh, very good. Okay, now remember this is a separate cylinder. Now we have to put the top link for the three-point hitch in. I want you to put that forward. Now I have to take these legs and put them on top. Before we plant, we have to open the soil up with a subsoiler. And then we have to plow it. And then let it set for a little while, a few weeks, while weeds come up, and then we'll plow it again. That way we don't have to use Roundup or 2,4-D or any of the other weed sprays. We can continue to garden in an organic fashion and put in organic corn. So the subsoiler pulled up a big, big rock. And that's I'm right. Not even sure if the tractor's big enough to be able to move that rock. It may be too heavy for the front loader of the tractor. So we may have to just push this rock aside. We may have to plow around it and just leave it here. Basically, it's another problem that we have to solve in the daily life of working a small farm. So this is going to be Jan's first time working with the front end loader, and we'll see how it goes. Come forward, a little more. A little more. Okay, good. Now lift this to the bucket. Perfect. Now you can lift it. Get it out of here. Put it in the bushes. So we've run into another hazard, which is that there's an old buried piece of metal, it's not even pipe, it's rod, that's sticking out of the ground that's got a point on it. And eventually either a horse is going to fall on it, somebody like me is going to fall on it, or it's going to hit the tractor tire and put a hole in the tractor tire. So we just got to dig it out, it's no big deal. So yeah. It's the same story as the stone. Now that you're used to doing that, I'm going to point you to where the metal rod is, and then we're just going to put the cultivator on, break up these lumps, and we'll be done. Okay, lift. Perfect, lift. And that's it for this week. We'll see you next week
on Fallout.